In 2021, the global alcoholic beverages market reached $1.45 trillion and is expected to expand at a compounded annual growth rate of 10% from 2022 to 2028. And in the U.S., the wines and spirits industry generates $122 billion in direct economic impact, creating over 2 million jobs and paying more than $47 billion in local, state, and federal taxes. But what is the cost of the alcohol industry? I'm Christy I, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today we're going to be breaking down the lucrative costs of the hard beverage industry and the hidden costs associated with it. We see various celebrities jumping into the spirits industry, from Ryan Reynolds' Aviator Gin to LeBron James' Lobos Tequila. And it's easy to see why they're so attracted to this industry, where the average standard margins are at 60% gross. So how are the margins for these spirits so high? Well, for scotch and whiskey, they're not particularly expensive to make. The glass bottle itself sometimes can be more expensive than the actual liquid. Barley, yeast, grain, and water are all that you need, which comes out to only about a dollar a bottle, plus the electricity it takes to run the distillery. Then you have the cask cost, which is highly variable between the Spanish oak, the ex-sherry barrels, etc. And this can cost anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000. So produced at scale, a simple bottle of scotch would cost less than $3 a bottle. If the liquor were to be aged, then the cost would go up, given the cost of time and the loss due to the evaporation due to the aging process. So the fancy glass bottles and packaging would add about another $2, but by far the biggest cost is the taxes. By law, scotch must first be sold to an importer that then sells the bottle to a wholesaler or distributor. Beyond just the markup, the wholesaler pays taxes and the cost of their wholesale licenses and both state and federal taxes. By the time the wholesaler actually distributes to the retailer then puts between a 25 to 33% markup on the bottles, which goes to the end consumer. And that is how a bottle that actually only costs about $8 to produce sits on the shelf for $39.99. And then on the other end of the spectrum, tequila has a lower profit margin, though still quite decent at around 30 to 50%. And currently, at a rate of 28 pesos per kilo, a truckload of agave needed to fill a 25-ton oven would cost around $36,000. And that's just the one ingredient on one oven load. Agave is the largest expense in tequila, and for a 1 liter bottle of traditionally made Blanco tequila, the agave would cost about $11.33 per bottle. Then when you add the cost of packaging, excise taxes, distillery fees, harvest, and transportation, that would add another $15.86 in the cost just to have a finished product. Then when we have to factor in the markups that occur at the distributor and the retail levels, the markup can vary, but it usually is between 35 to 45%. So that brings the entire price tag back up to $25.40 per bottle. And this does not include the cost of marketing, PR, travel expenses, sample products to give away, or even salary. So with all of these costs included, the total cost of a bottle is approximately $35 before you can start now turning a profit. So to get everything up and running, you will need to spend between $500,000 to $1 million to start. And there are currently about 2,345 different brands of tequila on the market. In 2019 alone, there were 181 new brands simply entering the market to fight for shelf space, with hundreds more, as there's always ample demand for tequila. And now for more, let's go to Avik Bhattacharya, Senior Policy Analyst at the Institute of Alcohol Studies. Why are the global excise taxes for liquor so expensive, and Actually, why do even excise taxes exist in the first place?
So basically, there are three different reasons why governments might choose to tax alcohol. So the first one is because alcohol causes harm to other people. So we have a transaction between the shop or the bar that's selling the alcohol and the consumer. But there's what's called an externality, because someone might go out and drink and drive. They might go out and get into a fight. They might hurt people in various other ways. And for that reason, in the same way as we might want to put a tax on carbon dioxide because it hurts the environment, we might want to put a tax on alcohol for that reason. The second reason is because governments want to promote the health of their citizens, because they know that people will drink harmfully, and this will have effect on their own health and on public healthcare systems. And so that's a second reason to put taxes on alcohol in order to discourage use. And the third reason is simply because governments need to raise taxes to pay for public services. And there's reasons why alcohol might be seen as one of the less kind of distortive or economically problematic taxes to levy in order if you're going to raise revenue. So I've done a fair bit of research looking at alcohol taxes and the benefits they have. And there's substantial evidence to show that raising alcohol taxes has benefits for population health. Basically, for every 1% you increase the price of alcohol, as a rough rule of thumb, we could expect drinking to fall by 0.5%. And that kind of downstream leads to lower health harms, kind of lower hospitalizations, fewer deaths. But the kind of other big strand of my research is really looking at the relationship between alcohol and the economy. And the kind of natural thing to do here is to link this to alcohol producers. The obvious kind of bit of the economy will be brewers and distillers who are producing alcohol, and the pubs and the bars and the supermarkets that are selling it. And so the conversation around alcohol in the economy is kind of dominated by, well, is this going to close down pubs and bars? Is this going to lose jobs in these industries? And what I've done is kind of said, well, hang on a minute, the people don't drink alcohol, they will generally spend that money on other things. So you're only looking at one part of the picture. So if alcohol consumption goes down, what about the gains in the other sectors? And how far do those net off? So I've worked with people to do some modeling on that. And that generally kind of offsets a large portion of the expected losses if we were to, say, put up taxes on alcohol. But then on top of that, the thing you have to remember is that because of the health harms of alcohol, that also has economic kind of problems. So people turning up for work hungover is a drain on productivity. People who have problems with alcohol being off sick and missing work that way also has problems for productivity. It's a contributor to unemployment. And then kind of most starkly and most tragically, people who die early are people who are, of all the other terrible things that are happening there, one of the things that is happening is that's people who are losing from the workforce. And so once you factor in those kind of health benefits and the impact that they have on the economy, my argument is that some of these restrictions on alcohol, which might be bad news for some alcohol producers, might actually on net be positive for the economy, or certainly not anywhere near as negative as we might fear.
Given all the celebrities that have now entered the liquor market, Ryan Reynolds with his gin, Ian Somerhalder with his bourbon, Kardashians and their tequila, is the liquor market really a lucrative business opportunity? Do the producers enjoy high margins, or is this simply a short-term money grab?
I mean, as in any kind of economic market, there's always a bit of guesswork and supposition going into trying to figure out whether it's going to grow or not. And this is a very different picture in different countries. So social trends in particularly in rich countries are moving towards growing awareness of the harms of alcohol. Young people are drinking less. So in the long term, I think there are definitely challenges for alcohol producers, which is why, for example, we're seeing kind of a shift towards no and low alcohol categories, for example, alcohol-free beer, which is more of a thing than it was before. So I think the kind of medium term outlook, certainly in rich countries, is probably quite negative. But it's a case of how long do those trends come into force? How far is public policy kind of supporting those trends in terms of kind of discouraging alcohol use or trying to support the alcohol industry? And it'll be very different from country to country, place to place, depending on what the kind of cultural background is and what the political and economic context is.
Has production of these spirits exceeded demand, or will there always be ample demand growing to meet the booming supply?
Yeah, I need to think. Off the top of my head, I don't know where we are globally, but I think in a lot of rich countries, it does seem like we kind of crested the wave across much of Europe and the US as well. I think that the amount of alcohol, the volume of alcohol that people are consuming is probably on a downward trajectory in most countries, although how fast it's going will vary from place to place, and where it peaked is different from place to place. Although just because people are drinking less isn't necessarily economically bad news. If you can, for example, encourage people to trade up to more premium products, so drinking less, but drinking more premium products, or if people are drinking in pubs and bars and restaurants and the like, where generally that'll be higher margin compared to buying in like supermarkets and grocery stores and the like, which will be lower margin. So I think overall from a health perspective, hopefully coming over the crest of the wave. But that doesn't necessarily, certainly in the short term, have to mean kind of bad news for the alcohol industry.
Thank you so much, Avik, for your time and insight. And when we come back, what are the hidden costs of alcohol, and which includes the cost of mortality, loss of productivity, and other healthcare-related costs? We'll look into that after the break.
When all truths seem wrong, when all rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
U.S. is a danger to the world, as it is, and because it has all this economic power that it uses for the military.
These are sick and twisted people that care about nothing but money and power. It's not even hate. I think they're indifferent. They just want money and power, and they're indifferent to who dies, as long as they can get that money and power.
Ensure that Joe Biden does not receive 4 more years.
Do you believe Trump?
As a general rule, no, never.
We must conduct a top-to-bottom overhaul to clean out the festering rot and corruption of Washington, D.C.
Oh, Biden is pushing us to World War III. I mean, you have to consider that is the worst. I mean, we should never be in this position. The U.S. has no business in Ukraine.
About some of the hidden costs of alcohol. Nationally in the U.S., alcohol consumption costs society $249 billion per year, and within that figure includes the cost of mortality, lost productivity such as being absent from work, healthcare-related costs for treating alcohol-related injuries, and finally, crime related to alcohol consumption. On an individual level, one also has to deal with a higher insurance cost if alcohol leads to a DUI. One little DUI can increase insurance by around 300% or more for car insurance. And that amounts to, on average, $2,000 or more a year, depending on where you live. Health and life insurance costs will also go up, assuming that the insurance company even qualifies you for the insurance policy. And on top of that, legal bills arising from a DUI will also be costly. These stem from DUI charges, fixing arrest warrants, attorney fees, fines, driver's ed training, etc. And this will also impact your ability to find a job, as most positions require a background check. One study from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse found that from 1999 through 2017, per capita consumption of alcohol increased by 8%, and the number of alcohol-related deaths doubled, which many caused by liver disease. And while this figure is alarming, the U.S. is not alone. In fact, while Americans on average consume 8.7 liters of pure alcohol per capita annually, it is not the worst offender. The country with the highest rate of alcohol use disorder and alcoholism is actually Hungary, with 21.2% of the total population afflicted. This is followed by Russia at 20.9%, Belarus at 18.8%, Latvia at 15.5%, and then the U.S. at 13.9%. And for more, we have Dr. Charles Smith, Medical Director at Recovery First Treatment Centers. So what is the real cost of alcohol on society?
Well, the latest article that I read was actually published by the CDC. And in the United States, here's the annual cost, $249 billion, or translated to $850-some per person living in the United States. So the cost is enormous. It was $27 billion alone in healthcare costs. The rest of that $249 billion lost productivity, accidents, even could weigh in crime, et cetera, especially when you talk about DUIs and accidents and work-related accidents. So very expensive.
While the alcoholic beverage industry is one of the biggest industries in the world, are there actually any positives or benefits that come from alcohol? It seems like alcohol drives down productivity, impairs judgments, and promotes more negativity overall.
There are just a couple of skewed studies that I personally don't subscribe to their findings, but I even question how they were financed. But one was that moderate drinking alcohol lessens heart disease in a subset of the population, and that moderate to light drinking of alcohol decreases cerebrovascular accidents or strokes. Most of the experts that I've heard from National Institute of Drug Abuse and National Institute of Health basically debunked those studies. And the latest that I'm hearing people say is alcohol is poison. Alcohol is a disinfectant. It's not for human consumption. Yet for thousands of years, humans have used it and abused it both. But I always tell my patients, do you ever go to the doctor and he said, I think you should start drinking? Okay. He's definitely going to say, we want you to watch your salt. We want you to watch your weight. We want you to be compliant with your blood pressure medicines. Of course, don't smoke cigarettes. And then he takes it for granted. Don't drink alcohol.
How much does alcoholism affect society, and is alcoholism rising?
Once again, there's a certain subset of the population that are at risk. I don't think I have any information to show that it's a higher percent of the population than it ever was. We're certainly more attuned to it now, and the diagnosis is being made better. We do know this. Of patients with alcohol use disorder in the United States, only 1 in 10 ever receive formal treatment. So 90% don't ever get treatment, and they live their lives on out with all the consequences of alcohol. Many live to be 50s, 60s, maybe even 70s, but they have a whole plethora of health consequences, liver, heart, high risk of cancer. We know alcohol is actually a level one carcinogen, but yet you don't see that warning label like we now have posted on cigarettes.
Now, alcohol has always been used as a social lubricant throughout human history. Is there any replacements for something like alcohol, or will it always continue to have a prominent place in society despite its negative effects?
Quite possibly. We don't know where science is going to take us. There may be an anti-anxiety medication for people that have, social anxiety, or people that may have some anxiety over speech or meeting new people. That's going to be one of the things that keeps alcohol around for a long time. I mean, obviously we have some things that would relieve social anxiety, but they can end up being worse than alcohol. Valium, Xanax, Klonopin. That's not a good idea as a social lubricant for sure. Mm-hmm. Neither would cocaine or methamphetamine or heroin, for that example. So most people that use cannabis don't necessarily become more social. If anything, they become antisocial. That's where the word stoned came from. So they just sit around and stay stoned all the time. So I don't know if it will actually replace that part. People may finally come to the conclusion, as many of us in recovery have, that life's simply better without mind-altering substances. With patients, I use this little thing all the time that I borrowed from an old Army commercial, be all you can be. Mm-hmm. So what I tell patients, I said, for you to be the happiest, healthiest person that you can be, it's without mind-altering substances. Let this brilliance of a computer and body that we have been born with flourish and do what it's meant to do. Because all of these other substances, particularly alcohol, are a deterrent. And sometimes they'll go along with me and it makes sense to them. Other times they have such a tight ingrain with reward, with success, with celebration. It's like, well, how could I ever have fun again? How could I ever be rewarded for success? How could I win that Super Bowl and not pop a champagne bottle? But I think through education, we may find out that the world isn't flat. And smarter, cooler heads will prevail and people will stop drinking disinfectant. I don't know when that will happen, though.
While the alcoholic beverages industry continues to boom for now, nothing lasts forever. And current studies have found that Gen Zers actually drink less than their older counterparts as they fear what will happen when they lose control and how their actions may appear on social media. As a result, they consume less than their parents' generations did as teenagers. About 20% less per capita, actually. A survey found that 57% of Gen Zers said they'd rather go to the gym for an hour rather than go to a bar. And 69% of them find heavy drinking culture boring. 49% of them claim that their online image is always at the back of their mind. 41% of these Gen Zers associate drinking with the loss of control, vulnerability, anxiety, and even abuse. And this decline in youth drinking is widespread in most high-income European countries, as well as the US, Australia, and New Zealand. Another reason for this shift is perhaps that Gen Zers have a deeper awareness of health risks given their access to the internet and social media. With Gen Zers now accounting for a third of the global population, the alcohol industry is adapting to young people's new preferences with things like mocktails, hard seltzers, hard kombucha, and beer with very little alcohol. So while the alcohol industry seems to be losing its shine with the younger generation, it still enjoys massive popularity with the older generations for now. I'm Christy I. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you back here next time on The Cost of Everything.